Recently, I reposted one of my very first episodes that talked about the audition process in symphony orchestras and how it models the decision-making process among highly trained musicians. I was on two audition panels this spring, and I was impressed with my colleagues' ability to distill all the factors leading to the winning candidate. Maybe we were lucky, too, because in each audition there were less than 20 candidates. At some point, we all reach a saturation point in how much information we can take in and evaluate correctly. What I mean is there's a point where there is too much information. Maybe it's too many choices, perhaps too many candidates, and we have a hard time comparing the 35th candidate with the second or the 12th. It can also mean too much information about the individual candidates. So we were also lucky we had a screen, so the identities of the candidates were unknown to us up until the winner was announced. Each candidate performed the same thing, and it was exactly 10 minutes. So apples to apples for much of the audition, and not too long of an audition to stress the committee's attempt to be as fair as possible. The amount of knowledge and experience that goes into making solid comparisons between candidates is impressive. What are the panel really listening for when they pick a winner? How do we distill years of musical study and experience into a 10-minute listening test? Welcome back to Accelerando. I'm Paula Tuttle, and today we're going to dive into what makes a performance authentic. Okay, I've said it. The panel behind the screen is listening for authenticity in a player. There's a level of technique as well as an understanding of style and execution. But let's back up a bit, because as I mentioned, I'm really proud of the player's abilities to parse the different technical and musical factors in such a short time. Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky were a famous team of behavioral psychologists who tested human beings' ability to evaluate other people. Their work became really famous in their field because they came up with tests that were really unique, and they showed how human beings made mistakes when they were making decisions. For example, one of these tests, they would give information to people about an individual and ask them to determine what they thought the subject's job was. And what they found is that consistently, people, when they were given too much information, they diverged from the statistical probabilities in favor of their own gut experience. So if they told people that an individual had a bunch of personality traits, the people would make assumptions about the vocation of that subject. But if they just gave people the statistics, then people stuck to the data. Very simple. There are far more many farmers than librarians, for example. So even if the description matches a librarian, people ignored the probability that the subject is far less likely to be a librarian than a farmer. It's human nature, and it's really hard to fight it. According to Kahneman and Tversky, people become insensitive to prior probabilities of outcomes, and inevitably, they are wrong more often as a result of ignoring the data-driven information available. Orchestra committees aren't immune to making these mistakes. We're pretty good at considering candidates behind the screen. What about in front of the screen? When we add descriptions about candidates to the straight data, we might be overwhelmed. If we know the candidates, it becomes even harder. But it is possible to keep your head straight. We have to have a very specific idea of what we're looking for. This could translate into knowing the pieces very well. But at some point, we could know the aspects so well, we might even recognize a player behind the screen. I was listening to violinists, so I wasn't able to play the concertos they chose, but I also didn't know who the candidates were. I confess, I often tried to imagine who they were, because several of my colleagues were auditioning for a promotion. Even more reason to keep the screen up. So as I said, we're a panel of extremely experienced musicians, all string players, listening to well-prepared musicians playing almost all the exact same material. Apples to apples, as they say. With the exception of the concerto and a movement of Bach. So let's move to the finals of one audition where the screen was removed per the contract specifications. And the MD asked for each violinist to play a movement of Bach. What does Bach represent in terms of authenticity? When a player presents a piece of Bach, what was the conductor hoping to hear? Everyone plays Bach a bit differently. The same audition required a Mozart concerto. A bunch of candidates played the Mozart concerto number 5. So as I mentioned, I'm not a violinist, but my experience with this concerto was shaped early in my college training when I played it with Sidney Harth. This is a recording of his. There is really little room for variation in terms of style and tempo. We pretty much hear everyone doing the prescribed speed, dynamics, and the style the same. So we have another apples-to-apples scenario, and everyone on the panel has this knowledge. The candidates that passed the prelims all fulfilled the requirements by showing their knowledge of standard practice. Their interpretations were authentic. The Bach we left to the finals, and deciding authenticity in Bach is a very different challenge. There are different tempos, and even different styles, and believe it or not, different tunings. There could be different dynamics, and the notes might even be different because there are different copies. In some other scenario, determining authenticity could go so far as how it was played in the time of J.S. Bach. The pitch was several frequencies lower in Baroque times. But if a candidate were to tune his instrument below 440 in order to audition for a modern symphony orchestra, they would be making a big mistake. In our audition, the violinists needed to demonstrate their understanding of authenticity within particular guidelines. To veer into ornamentations done by Baroque performers or playing on gut strings and the like, it wouldn't help them get promoted. The same might be said of other interpretation. There were safe measures there as well. The word authentic is very nuanced, and maybe this is why it was chosen as the word of the year in 2023 by the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. It means not false or imitation. It does mean real and actual. It's also a word that sends people to the dictionary often. It's a positive word. It modifies. Musicians and pop singers get this word attached to them in headlines like 3 ways to tap into Taylor Swift's authenticity. It's associated with pop culture's superpower, and it brands celebrities. It's also a very important word with the rise of artificial intelligence and its impact on deepfake videos, academic honesty, and so many other topics that blur the line between real and fake. A move towards authenticity or embracing authenticity is a sign of our times. For example, Elon Musk made headlines when he said, "People should be more authentic on social media." And now, when people show authenticity, the money follows. Authentic content is now recognized as the gold standard of trust. But with any buzzword, well, it gets abused or used in contexts not deserving of that classification. Now the word authentic is becoming performative, meaning for show. So once again, we the consumers, we need to evaluate what's being put before us. Determine authenticity on every level. Don't just accept it because of the label. In music, there's always been a level of discerning what's real. Miles Davis, who said a lot of quotable things, maybe he's like Yogi Berra there. He told Prince's producer once that some of the best musicians aren't musicians. I think he was talking about authenticity. He asked Susan Rogers if she was a musician. They were at Prince's house and working in his home studio. Susan didn't play an instrument, but she had very good ears for audio engineering. So she said no when asked if she was a musician. Miles Davis smiles and replies, "That's okay. Some of the best musicians aren't musicians." And I think we all see the truth in that. When rock musicians talk about authenticity, they have two categories. They call it above the neck and below the neck. Obviously, above the neck is the brain. Below the neck is the heart and the hips. Above the neck is cerebral. Below the neck is where we talk about the groove. To delineate these two kinds of authenticity, musicians often point to J.S. Bach as definitely above the neck. Its clarity and precision benefits listeners, whether they are trained musicians or not. So for a below-the-neck composer, I'm going to stick my neck out here and claim Rachmaninoff as one. Because his music is the kind, and this is to me talking, my opinion, if the lines don't always line up perfectly, it might be better, and maybe intended by the composer. Not that it's sloppy, but the character is fluid. It's authentic, and it has so much heart in it. Even within rock music, this separation happens above and below the neck, particularly with the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, because listeners seem to choose one or the other camp. The Beatles is deemed above the neck because of the precision in the composition and the engineering. The Stones is more bluesy and, well, below the neck, not as clean, maybe more fluid. So getting back to the audition, the music director of the ballet orchestra, Charles Barker, he requested both Bach and Mozart for the solo pieces. And obviously, they both require attention to technique and precision. They are clearly both above the neck. But as I said, there are just as many listeners that gravitate to below-the-neck performances. And these below-the-neck players are often not as technical. The music doesn't always line up. And there's a lot of room for improvement sometimes. One really great story that demonstrates this is the saga of the rock group called the Shags, S-H-A-G-G-S. A woman who lived in rural New Hampshire read her son's palm. Already questionable groundwork, right? She saw that her son would marry a girl with strawberry blonde hair. Then she saw the couple would have two sons after she, the son's mom, died. Then the couple would have three daughters. And her final prediction was the three daughters would form a rock band. The young man's name was Austin Wiggin, and he was very poor. His whole family was poor. He didn't have any trust in what his mother predicted until the first two things came true, and then the third. He married a woman with strawberry blonde hair. Okay, that's no biggie. He had two sons after his mom died. Then when he had three daughters, he started thinking there was something to this prophecy, and he would conduct seances, and he was like trying to talk to his mom. So Austin made his three girls learn music, and they were pretty bad. But somehow they played together in their own little universe, and they made an album called Philosophy of the World, and it's taken on a cult following. It was recorded in 1969, and the audio engineers thought it was a joke. They cut 1,000 copies of the record. Austin took 100 of them. 900 of them sat in the studio, and they were just handed out to people, kind of like a joke, the way classical musicians passed around tapes of Florence Foster Jenkins. It was at least a decade later. People wanted the group to reform. The girls actually despised playing together, and they only did it to comply with their father's strict demands. They broke up as soon as they were old enough. When their music suddenly got famous, they did get back together. Maybe because they had jobs as cleaners and janitors, and the music paid more. Tom Cruise actually wanted to get the rights to their story to make a film, and lots of people declare the Shags as the most authentic group ever formed. Frank Zappa and Bonnie Raitt were two musicians that declared the Shags a great band. Terry Adams of the New Rhythm and Blues Quintet, or NRBQ, described the Shags' approach to music as outside the normal thinking process of songwriting at the time, and that their music needed to be heard. So Terry Adams, he convinced the sisters to reissue their album. At first, the girls were afraid they'd have to pay for it themselves. They were mostly unaware of the craze that was building around their music. Rolling Stones magazine said this about the 1980 reissue of Philosophy of the World. "It's the sickest, most stunningly awful, wonderful record in ages." Rolling Stones gave the Comeback of the Year award to the Shags and their album. The Village Voice wrote, "How do they sound? Perfect. They can't play a lick, but they have the right attitude, which is what rock and roll is all about." Bob Dylan called the album a landmark of rock and roll history. Today, a copy of Philosophy of the World from the original 1,000 copies goes for $10,000. Why? Part of it is the crazy story that lends authenticity to the three musicians that had a kind of telepathy, if you will. Their music doesn't always line up, but somehow they made it happen. The type of music that the Shags did has a name. It's called naive music. Music created by self-taught or naive musicians. The vice president of RCA said, "Philosophy of the World is basic and innocent, the way the music business used to be." In 1999, The New Yorker ran a profile on the Shags, and that's the article that Tom Cruise optioned for a film. The whole story reeks of authenticity, the way they formed, the naive quality of their music, and the fact that all three girls hated the whole project. It's so endearing to people that choose this kind of music. Definitely below the neck. And it all comes down to one very important fact. Listening is an active part of the music. Without listeners, there is no music. And whatever floats your boat, it's your business. But nonetheless, there's a consensus among listeners about authenticity. Whether it's above the neck or below the neck, people know authenticity when they hear it. And that's it for this week. Please share this episode with someone you think would like it. Thank you for listening, and please support the music performed by your favorite live bands. classical, jazz, rock, above the neck or below. It's only important if it's authentic. Bye now.